This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Please can nobody go back and listen to the pod where Spurs were top and Arsenal were bottom. I'm not sure it's aged that well. Three games later and now they're both in mid-table mediocrity, yet somehow both interesting enough to talk about. In some detail, does Arteta actually have a plan? Or was Nuno so planless it made it look like Arsenal had one? Is Arteta the next Arsene Wenger, as Gael Clichy said? Manchester United lose at home to Aston Villa. Was Bruno's apology long enough? Should it at least have been a three-tweet thread? And did he take the penalty because Ronaldo has just completely stopped moving? At the Bridge, Pep doesn't over or under, he just thinks things and gets it right with the brutally professional subduing of Thomas Tuchel. Just down the road, the game of the weekend is at Brentford as they share six goals with Liverpool. In fact, almost all the games in the Premier League are fun, even Watford, Newcastle. Elsewhere, an Ipswich player goes all Gary Crosby, Robbie Keane, Dion Dublin. Fulham players are nice. There's an update from Suriname. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. So today, if there was one panellist I could imagine downing a beer on the first tee to G up the pod fans before taking on the enemy, it's Jacob Steinberg. Jacob, welcome.
Hello.
Applying for an HGV licence so he can reverse his lorry-sized opinions about Dean Smith out of the podcast, it's Jordan Jarrett-Bryan.
Hello, mate. How are you?
And there's petrol in his tank. It's Barry Glendenning. Hello, Barry.
Good God. Just as a point of information, Max, the yes. HGV test, just to make it a bit easier for people to pass, you don't actually have to do a reverse manoeuvre in it anymore. So expect to see loads, loads of traffic chaos in the coming years as lots of lorry drivers who can't reverse are released into the community. What could possibly go wrong?
Let's start at the Emirates then. Arsenal 3, Tottenham 1. So yeah, as we went into the international break, Spurs were top of the league with 9 points and Arsenal were bottom of the league with no points. Now Spurs are 11th with 9 points and Arsenal are 10th with 9 points. One of those Arsenal really good, Tottenham really bad type games. Jordan, you are an Arsenal fan. How much pleasure did this give you?
A great pleasure. Yeah, brilliant performance from the boys. They were released from the dressing room like, I don't know, lions from a cage. They just came out on it big time from the get-go. They just swarmed Tottenham and really battered them in that first kind of 35, 40 minutes. Some really good performances from Aubameyang, who I think this season has been absolutely disgraceful. I thought he was brilliant yesterday, my man of the match, actually. Tomiyasu's looking like a really, really... smart acquisition for Arsenal. The youngsters have been spoken about. Emil Smith-Rowe and Saka. Odegaard, I thought, was brilliant. I think the whole thing was great. Arteta's been rightfully slammed and battered this season so far, but I think he deserves a lot of credit for yesterday. It was a needed game. But I must say, not to dampen my own joy too much, Arsenal always beat Spurs at Arsenal. They always beat Spurs at the Emirates. That wasn't a shock in that sense. It's very easy to get up for a North London derby, I feel, for Arsenal. So whilst they deserve rightful credit for the win, the big game I felt, even before the North London derby, was the Brighton game. At the point of listening to this podcast, for most people, Brighton could be top of the league. So that's the game where I'm really looking to see if Arsenal have turned a corner here indeed. And all this talk about who finishes higher out of Arsenal and Spurs. It's just two average teams that are just in really weird stages of the season. But yeah, let's give Arsenal some credit because they were phenomenal. I thought Spurs were disgraceful, but I'll let others pick up on Spurs.
I wonder, Barry, if we were sort of naive to be so critical of Arteta when he was missing quite a few important players in those games where Arsenal weren't very good at all.
I don't think so. They were playing badly. Lots of teams have to cope with injuries and suspensions, and some managers do it better than others. I looking at the reaction to this game, and I think Arsenal fans, while they have every right to be hugely impressed with yesterday's performance, they weren't up against much, and one swallow doesn't make a summer. Tottenham were woeful yesterday. I did expect Arsenal to win, but I was surprised by just how bad Tottenham were.
Yeah, we'll get on to Tottenham in a second, Jacob. I wondered what you made of Arsenal's performance. I thought there were lots of excellent performances, including, you know, right from the way back, from Ramsdale at the back, who seems to have brought in a bit of confidence in that position. Smith Rowe was excellent. I thought Saka had a great game as well.
Yeah, obviously Ramsdale was someone who was quite a few raised eyebrows when they went for him, given that he'd obviously been relegated in both of the last two seasons. And there seemed to be a lot of Arsenal fans, maybe on social media, which maybe doesn't always give a fair portrayal, who seemed quite downbeat about it. But he obviously is someone who they feel is, for a start, good with the ball at his feet. Leno hasn't always convinced. Ramsdale has made a good start so far, which is encouraging, and you know, maybe shows that he was perhaps a little bit unlucky to be in teams that weren't defending too well in the last couple of seasons. And you know, Granit Xhaka, reading Nick Ames's piece this morning in The Guardian, singling him out for praise. Obviously someone who the previous appearance was not something that he'll want to remember against Manchester City, and you know, a player who seemed to sum up Arsenal's dysfunction in that, you know, he was obviously seen that he was off in the summer, and then, you know, then he's captaining the side with a new contract, and within that game he's getting sent off after 40 minutes with the team 3-0 down. But yesterday he played really well in a way that he can, in the way that he showed at the Euros that he can. And, you know, further forward you've got Smith Rowe, Saka, Odegaard, and that little trio behind Aubameyang when he's on it, who's one of the best strikers in the world. They're really exciting. The problem is, as Jordan said, that you're never quite sure whether this is going to be sustained and whether there's just another terrible Brentford-style performance coming around the corner, which will just sort of plunge everything back into despair again.
The one player that I can't give credit to, and it's not actually his fault, for Arsenal, was Ben White, because for an hour, he didn't have anything to do. So it's really hard to judge how well Ben White played yesterday, because for the first 60, 65 minutes, he didn't really have any defending to do. And I think Tony Adams made a really interesting point that wasn't picked up on in the pre-match chat on Sky, where he said that he felt that, is there a difference between Rob Holding and Ben White? Is there a £50 million difference between the two centre-backs? And it got me thinking. I thought to myself, okay, Rob Holding maybe isn't the answer, but I've had doubts about Ben White even at this early stage anyway. So I'm still waiting to really see, and it is early, so I don't want to be too harsh, but I'm still waiting to see a performance from Ben White to make me think this is the guy that's going to anchor a defence that can really kick on, make Arsenal kick on. And Arteta, finally as well, I thought was demonstrability, I said that word wrong, go on Max, you can say it.
No, I'm enjoying you trying. Keep going.
No, go on, help me out. Demonstrability, anyway, you know what I mean.
Demonstrably.
There you go. He was visibly very, very, very excited at the final whistle, like we'd won a league. But something clearly has happened there that's made him feel like it's been a really, really, really interesting period for him as Arsenal manager. And he definitely showed it.
Nuno admitted he got it wrong. I mean, Ben White, you say, you couldn't tell if he had a good game because he had nothing to do. It's sort of Harry Kane stumbling around and falling over. It was all quite bleak. The team looked totally imbalanced. Miguel Delaney from The Independent tweeting, Nuno should go. He's not fit for the club. Lars, not so much a performance as a cry for help so far from Spurs this. Barry, they were bad.
Yeah, they're absolutely appalling in the first half when the game was lost. And for all that, they did have chances to nick a point, maybe. You know, Lucas Moura had a shot palmed onto the bar. Kane lifted one wide. You'd normally expect him to score in his sleep. He headed wide from a corner as well, when an inform him would probably have scored. But they were overrun in midfield. Their defence was poor. They didn't seem to care particularly about the outcome of the game, which is quite worrying considering how important it is to their fans. And Nuno said afterwards that he had a plan, but he wasn't able to implement it. But I couldn't see what it was, unless the plan was for Tanguy Ndombele and Dele Alli to just wander around aimlessly, not sprint very often, and for Eric Dier to loft long balls forward in, you know, the forlorn hope of picking out Kane or Heung-min Son. It was a weird, lethargic, pretty aimless and lackluster performance from Tottenham.
I want to talk about Dele Alli. We talked a lot about Kane and quite a lot about Ndombele, but I've always really liked him as a footballer, Jacob, but at the moment I can't really see what he does.
I'm not surprised that you always liked him as a footballer, because he was pretty phenomenal for a good few years. He turned up at Tottenham at age of, well, he was a teenager in 2015 from League One, and immediately just slotted into the Premier League like it wasn't a challenge for him. And then was quite easily one of the best players in the league for quite a long time, and in a team that for a couple of seasons were proper title challengers under Maurizio Pochettino. And that partnership that he had going with Harry Kane, Christian Eriksen, was one of the best in the league. You know, there was a couple of seasons, wasn't it, where prolific goal scorer alongside Kane, threat in the air, really clever. And then since then, you sort of question certain parts of, is he precisely how motivated is he? Obviously, it didn't, there was a personality clash with Mourinho, who didn't really see where he would fit into his side, questions over his application and the work rate and whether he was suited to playing as a number 10 in a Mourinho team. He's one of those players, like a lot at Spurs, who you think probably should have gone. And I think that comes back to Daniel Levy, the fact that he holds on to players probably beyond, you know, what their top value would have been. And that all comes back to something that Pochettino was, you know, quite clearly angling for quite a long time when he was at Tottenham, when they were on the up and when he had, you know, this team that probably looked like it needed to be slightly regenerated, tweaked and everything. He wanted certain players to be sold, and it didn't happen. And, you know, that was a cause of his dissatisfaction there. Ends up going very badly with the best manager that they've had in the Premier League era. And they, instead of sticking with him, it gets to a point where they had no option but to probably part ways, because he had completely lost it when it could have gone in a different direction. And, you know, now they are where they are, having tried it with Jose, and you come to, you know, nobody was particularly surprised when that doesn't happen. And then after a 50-day search, you end up with a manager who you first of all didn't want in Nuno. And he's not a bad manager, but he doesn't seem like he's the right fit for Tottenham. And if you're a player there, then you wonder why it is that you're being coached by a guy who was roughly sixth, seventh, eighth choice, having, you know, gone through so many others. It's a really troubled club at the moment. It's not a surprise what happened yesterday to me.
Let's go to Old Trafford. Manchester United 0, Aston Villa 1. Brilliant result for Villa. Their first at Old Trafford for 12 years, and they fully deserved it. I'm going to call it, Jordan. Your Villa pantomime, it's done now, isn't it?
It's never done, Max.
You can't keep it going now, because you've got nothing to cling to. Here's a manager who improves players, who gets the best out of players, who lost his talisman and managed to replace it with great recruitment, and you can only applaud them.
I'm just upset that these good times are happening to that set of supporters. That's my only really regret, really. But I watched the game. I was at the Talk Sport studios watching some of the 3 o'clock games, and Villa should have been 3 up at half time. They should have been 3-0 up by half time. They fully deserved to win the game. I, for once, was cheering with the Villa fans when Fernandes missed that penalty. I like Aston Villa. It's just the fans. I like Aston Villa. They're a good team.
Oh, yeah, but Dean
Smith is a decent manager.
Every club has these fans. Like,
they have more than most. They have more than most, Max. They have more than most. But I was glad they won the game. Not only because we all have a collective dislike of United, but they deserve to win the game. I think they've got some really good players. You mentioned recruitment there. It's been really, really good. I thought they were unlucky in some of their previous games before this anyway, really, to be honest. A couple of Chelsea games, I thought that they were really impressive in as well. So they got what they deserved. I tipped Villa. If you remember when we did our preview, we did our predictions, I had them, I think, sixth or seventh this season. So, you know, I'm not anti-Aston Villa. It's just the supporters. But no, this was a really good game that I thought they deserved to get 3 points from. I loved Martinez's S-housery around the penalty situation. I did think it was a penalty. I know some people were saying they didn't think it was. I did think it was a penalty. Although his hand is down by his waist, he's blocked the ball going to Paul Pogba. So if his hand's not there, then there's a goal-scoring chance. So I think it was a penalty. But overall, I was glad they won the game.
I mean, if his hand isn't there, then he doesn't have a hand, does he? I don't think it was a penalty, but by the letter of the law, it might be, and I don't care massively.
Where's Lars?
Yeah, the two moments of the game, Barry, were the penalty and the goal. Let's start with the penalty, because there were lots of great parts to this weren't there? There was Martinez exactly pointing at Ronaldo. There was Fernandez not doing his little hop skip and blasting it into orbit. And then there was this sort of like essay, you know, on penalties by Bruno Fernandez. It was sort of ludicrous, wasn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter to me whether players feel compelled to apologise anytime they make a mistake, but it's becoming a theme. I don't know if it's the players themselves who are doing it or their social media teams, but presumably the player has to sign off on it before it goes out. It's pathetic, and I think it's unnecessary, and it's probably done as a sop to these mouth foaming supporters who get angry about everything on the internet. And I don't think they should be pandered to, but it was quite funny, and the length of his apology was, you know,
to write that many words between missing the penalty and getting it out was quite impressive, really. He could have a column, couldn't he?
But, sorry, go on.
Oh, no, okay. I wonder, Jacob, if I heard some people saying the fact that Ronaldo's on the pitch might make Bruno Fernandes think about taking the penalty more, i.e. there's more pressure on this penalty because if I miss it, because his record for Manchester United is brilliant from the penalty spot. He's missed 2 in 23. But the fact that Ronaldo's standing there makes him think, oh God, any miss now means I'm off these.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know what's
if anything,
case.
Max, maybe he was too warmed up. I also think,
let's not go there.
I also think the fact that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, whose name I briefly forgot there, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's constant moaning about not getting penalties and about refereeing decisions, that probably doesn't help either, because it piles the pressure on that when they finally do get a penalty, you know, oh God, I really have to score this now because my manager has been clucking like a hen for the last several weeks about, you know, refereeing decisions and conspiracies and how it's all Jurgen Klopp's fault that we don't get penalties.
And on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer himself, we've all discussed at length about his failings as a manager. But I do feel that those who do genuinely feel United can win a Premier League title have to look at the evidence. And the evidence is suggesting that Man United can go on crazy runs. They've probably got a 15-game, 20-game winning run now. But in the games like we saw on Saturday, they will always lose those games because he, in certain moments of games or certain matches themselves, he's not good enough to win a title. I don't care if you sign Ronaldo, Varane and Sancho, he is not a Premier League winning manager. And I personally think that the manager next season will be Pochettino. I think he will be there next year. I don't think he'll last at PSG this season. But I think that I asked those Ole supporters that genuinely feel he's the guy to really win a title. Well, the evidence suggests that in the moments that matter, he keeps failing. He's not the guy. He's a top four manager, maybe. He's proven he can do that. But I think we saw once again, there's more ammunition to the argument that when it comes to winning a Premier League title, you can't have those players on the pitch and not score past Aston Villa. Villa are a good team, but I'm sorry, the manager has to find a way to win that game, and he just didn't.
He's a top four manager, but that, you know, with an extremely stacked squad, so it's almost quite hard to not finish in the top four. I know that Mourinho and Van Gaal managed it a couple of times, but it should be really difficult for Manchester United with the resources that they have. And even when they don't get into the Champions League, they can still go and punt, you know, 50 million or more on a couple of players. I think, you know, in the summer that they didn't get into the Champions League one summer, it's 89 million on Pogba, which other clubs simply can't do. So, you know, Solskjaer, as you say, it's got to be judged on whether or not he can turn that into a title winning side. And potentially you think that this is a team that can go and turn it on in a knockout game you know, a bit like, say, Real Madrid did under Zidane a few times, where they didn't win that many titles, but in the Champions League, they had so much going for them on an individual basis that they were able to win those knockout games. But even then with Solskjaer, you know, you look at last week's defeat to West Ham in the Cup, and that's just another chance gone. The Europa League final, you know, twice in 2 years in the Europa League with that level of talent, they're not able to do it. And he's got pretty much a guarantee of a goal a game now as well to bail him out at certain points in Ronaldo. And it still looks like they don't know what their plan is, and compared to the other sides that are up there, it doesn't make much of a case for them to persist with this project.
Speaking of Solskjaer moaning, before we move on, he did moan about the goal, Barry. You can take it when it's a good goal against you, but that's offside. Watkins touched David De Gea as Courtney Houser heads the ball. I mean, under the get out of the way Harvey Barnes protocol, that is offside. I mean, I wouldn't want it to be given, but I sort of think he might have a point.
Yeah, he probably does. He certainly does, working on the Harvey Barnes protocol. But, you know, that's deflection, I think. Villa were the better team. They thoroughly deserved to win and probably should have won by more.
That'll do for part one. We'll go to Stamford Bridge at the top of part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Chelsea 0, Manchester City 1. Perfect start to Manchester City's week of death. Away at Chelsea, PSG and Liverpool. Pep's first win in four attempts against Tuchel's Chelsea. You were there, Jacob, and City were brilliant, I thought, in this game.
They were. It felt like a reminder just of how good they are. Because, it's been a little bit of a slow... I mean, they do start seasons slowly at times under Guardiola, even in seasons in which they've won the league. There have been a couple of funny results in August. And obviously, they started with the defeat at Tottenham, which, you know, given the context of the failure to sign Harry Kane, not really having a striker that you totally trust, seemed like a bit of a worry at the time. And, you know, people wondering, was Jack Grealish really what they needed? Was 100 million on another creative midfielder? You know, followed by the draw with Southampton last week, just a little bit of doubt starting to creep in. And then they turn up on Saturday, you know, at the home of the European champions, a team that had beaten them three times in a row, fairly, not let's say convincingly, but pretty impressively, you know, targeting certain weaknesses that City have on the counter attack and defending brilliantly against them. And they just didn't allow Chelsea to do anything. You know, there's certain points made about the system that Tuchel went with, which I think was a little bit unfair. So, you know, a bit like, what if this had been Mourinho? I don't think that was what Tuchel, if you watch Tuchel from the touchline, he's always very animated on the touchline, but on Saturday it was even more so. You know, very early on, you could tell that he was very worried and exasperated, angry about the way that his players weren't able to deal with the pressure that Manchester City were putting on them. Chelsea wanted to beat the press and come out. It wasn't about just kicking it long, but the way that Manchester City came out and just harried them off the ball over and over again. Defence was right on the halfway line all the time, even though they were, you know, Timo Werner to think about with his pace. And then from there, it was just impossible for Chelsea to play and get anything going, get any counter-attacks going. And, you know, it was, you're starting to wonder at certain points in the first half where not a lot of chances were being made by City at the same time, whether... Is this going to be another one where Chelsea just going to force them into crossing to Phil Foden, which would seem quite pointless, and that it's going to turn into a Tuchel master plan? Instead, they just grew in belief, having seized the initiative in the game. And the goal was a bit lucky, but after that, when they took the lead through Gabriel Jesus, who, you know, reinventing himself as a right winger, they were just impeccable. They should have won by more. Grealish, brilliant on the left. And, you know, Bernardo Silva was I can't understand, like many people, why they thought about selling Bernardo. Just so good in the slightly deeper role. And next to him, obviously, a big position that they got wrong in the Champions League final was obviously playing Gundogan as the deep midfielder. He couldn't actually do that on... he didn't have the option to do something stupid like that on Saturday because Gundogan was out. But Rodri was very good as well as the defensive midfielder, just cutting out everything. It was quite a scary performance. And you do start to think, could this, I know that they've still got to go to Liverpool on Sunday, but could this be one of those moments which suddenly just spark one of those terrifying winning runs from City, the kind that they went on last season, and suddenly just the title race goes like that?
When you're in the ground and you can see the whole shape of the game, I wonder if that kind of pressing, because it almost, when it starts to look like an art form, you know, and they all go at the same time, there is a kind of, even though it didn't lead to like a brilliantly exciting football match, there's a sort of an artistry to that, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where where you're quite low down at Stamford Bridge and you're watching certain points of it and you sort of, you understand what's going on. And then you've got these two, you're quite close to the managers at Stamford Bridge in the press box. And you've got these two guys who are so animated on the touchline and they're picking up points that are totally beyond the likes of us and suddenly going mad about something that you have no idea what you can spend quite a lot of time trying to work out what is it that they've suddenly spotted that I have no idea. Sometimes you can tell, you know, it's quite obvious if a move breaks down, but at other points it's like Guardiola's making all these weird hand gestures to somebody and it's obviously like move your position slightly 1 yard to the left or something like that. It'd be interesting to see what the response is from Chelsea because they haven't had a proper setback like this under Tuchel. He's generally more or less for a year now got pretty much every big game spot on, and that was one of those moments where you kind of you understand how important Mason Mount is to the he was missing on Saturday through injury, and you know a little bit underwhelming at the start of the season, but you can tell like his tactical intelligence, the link play that he had, he was missed quite a lot. A little bit of a question mark over Lukaku as well. Was that a bit more of the Manchester United Lukaku as opposed to the Inter one? And he's got it'll be interesting to see how they bounce back because it can turn quite quickly at Chelsea. And he's got slight little issues with some of the attacking midfielders as well. You know, not quite clicked yet. So that will be interesting to watch.
I like Wilson's line, Timo Werner, somebody willing to chase down every cul-de-sac just to make absolutely sure it is a cul-de-sac. was a nice line. Barry, is it about time we started taking Gabriel Jesus seriously? Have you not been taking him seriously up to this point? And are you about to take him very seriously?
That's quite an odd question. I rate him. I mean, I think his problem is that he's been forced to live in the shadow of slightly better players, but he is a good player. I mean, the way he created space to score that goal was you know, really impressive. I suspect there will be City fans who would rather a better, bigger name striker, but he's doing okay, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, on form, you'd have him over Kane. Mind you, you'd have a lot of players. We'll move on to Brentford-Liverpool, Jordan, and you'd have any one of the players who started up front or came on up front for Brentford over Harry Kane. When this game was absolutely brilliant, and the atmosphere, I thought, was amazing as well.
It was. It looked like a really fun game to be at. I had some friends that were there, friends of both supporters, and I was doing my show as it was on, and we were just distracted by the goals that kind of kept coming in that second half in particular. That front line of Brentford, I think, are going to score enough goals in the first half of the season to secure their safety. They may tail off post-Christmas, but I think they'll bank enough points between now and Christmas to pretty much ensure that they're okay. I think the likes of Norwich might be gone by January anyway, so that's one slot gone. So I think Brentford are going to really go for it in the next kind of 2 or 3 months to just kind of bank up those points. And the front line they've got, there's definitely goals in there. Tony, I think that he's a player that will be looked at by a lot of clubs as well. He works hard. I think his finishing is decent, but I think there's a ceiling there that I think he could definitely go to a higher level. And I like what he's about. He's got a little bit of swag about him. But he can play, and I think he's impressive too. The tactics that were employed by Brentford, I thought, were quite smart as well. There was a couple of really smart free kicks and set plays that they really clearly worked on and executed quite well as well in that game against Liverpool too. Liverpool, on the other side of things, were disappointed, I think, that they didn't take 3 points. I think they would still be expecting pre-match to have gone there and taken 3 points in this race to try and win the Premier League title. So I think they'll be a bit disappointed that they only left with a point. But I think by the time actually the game finished, I think both teams were just happy to get out there with a point.
It was interesting you mentioned those sort of tactical things. Thomas Frank, Barry, had decided to put three men at the back post on Trent Alexander-Arnold. And it makes you think, why has no one else thought of that? And surely that's quite risky, isn't it? Because then you've got three people on Trent Alexander-Arnold. That must be some Liverpool players who don't have anyone near them somewhere else.
Yeah, like you say, it is one of those innovations where you go, yeah, why has no one else done that before? Because it seems so blindingly obvious, but three big lads on Trent and, you know, swamp him. Brent, it worked. Brentford's approach was very direct, and I thought they were a little unlucky not to win, actually. But I love their first goal, that set piece. I don't think it will be in the reckoning for goal of the season, but I think it probably should be, because there were so many component.
What?
Oh man, that.
God, it's not goal of the. It's not goal of the season.
Goal of the month. Goal of the month.
A tap
for
in
sure.
For Ethan Pinnock. So, I mean, it's like it's.
Oh, it was a tap in. That's it. Just a tap in. That was a brilliantly worked goal.
I agree.
It reduced Liverpool's players to the status of confused bystanders. The one thing I would say is that I think on the training ground, it was Pontus Janssen's job to poke at home, and he missed. If Pinnock hadn't been there for the tap-in, I think Pontus Janssen would have been the subject of much opprobrium from his teammates, because he had the easiest job of everyone involved in that free kick, and there were quite a lot of people involved in that free kick, and he messed it up.
A goal of the season has to be a goal that makes you make a noise, and the only goal this weekend that made me make a noise was Sean Longstaff's for Newcastle. We'll get to that. Now, that is a prerequisite. I mean, I was impressed with that goal, but I can't be goal of the season.
It was a brilliant goal.
It was a lovely move. Granted, it was a lovely move. It wasn't just a tap-in, but I think goal of the season is,
I'd say,
is stretching. That's the sort of that, Barry, is the sort of sensationalism that people go elsewhere for, that we don't buy in. We don't buy into that sort of hyperbole here. Oh, I see you've gone quiet. Oh, we should say well done to Mo Salah. 100th goal in the top flight. 13th Liverpool player to do that. Fastest Liverpool player to get there, considering the company that he keeps in scoring 100 goals for Liverpool. That is very impressive. Leeds 1, West Ham 2. Ollie says, can we just have something nice from Jacob about how West Ham are massive and spreading the gospel of the Moyes sire, please?
They are still surprisingly pinch me good. And that in a season in which they've only done it once now, but obviously with the Europa League to consider as well, which is new for them, both in terms of playing in Europe and playing in the Thursday-Sunday, which is obviously quite taxing on your squad. But very, very good again on Saturday. A little bit lucky not to go 2-0 down on a couple of occasions against Leeds, but there's a team that sort of sticks at it. They've got great character as well as ability under Moyes. Don't roll over, and he is able to, sometimes without making substitutions, is able to sort of tweak things in games that swing it their way. They sort of force themselves onto teams at times with the physicality that then sort of allows the creativity to come through. Got to single out Jared Bowen, who I think is the only player who played three times in a week for them against the two United games, and then this. Obviously his goal was a little bit lucky, but taking the deflection. But again, he deserved it. It was a really good performance. He's very quick and direct. He's a very exciting player to watch. Not always got the end product to match it, but I think he's young, and that will still come. He's a very, very good signing, as they all really have been under Moyes. And then Antonio, I think Moyes himself said, was quite blunt, saying, I don't think it was his best performance for us. But, again, 6 goals in all competitions now. And, the kind of clinical finish from him that I don't think that you would have seen probably until just after we all came back from we all came back from lockdown, Project Restart. It's been a player transformed since then. So yeah, it's been it's going very well.
Strange time to exist where West Ham are like genuinely good. It seems incredibly strange. Yes, Jordan.
So let's ask Jacob a question. I mean, I still can't work out why West Ham are good. And I speak to some of my West Ham supporting friends, and they tend to always say to me, what's happened in the last year and a half is that they're just running more and working harder, and that's making an impact. And I just think it must be more than that, surely. Jacob, can you just briefly explain why West Ham look like a really good team right now?
Well, they do have good players, and they have spent on players in the last, despite, the criticism of the board, which has been fair at times. They have been spending, at certain points, not probably as much as people might have expected when they moved to the stadium, but good players, good attitude, and a manager who was written off, but is actually showing that not every job necessarily defines you, and that he's able to, he's now at a club, unlike certain clubs that he was at before, where it suits him, and he's been able to do what he essentially did at Everton, which was create a very good side for a very long time.
Yeah, I was wrong about him. I'm happy, David, to admit it, and I apologise.
Max, I don't buy this that people were wrong about David Moyes. I mean, he didn't do a very good job at Manchester United. He was diabolical at Sunderland. So it's not wrong to say he was bad in his role at Sunderland, because he clearly was, but now he's doing well.
Sorry, I was thinking the same thing over the weekend. Is David Moyes a good manager or not? You look at all the jobs he's had. Does the Everton and West Ham job, is that negated by the Sociedad, Sunderland and Man United? Man United, I think, is harsh because better managers than him failed there. Sociedad, all right, it didn't work out for him abroad. And at Sunderland, you'll know more than most. Most managers there fail. So are those really... Is it fair to say that he did, inverted commas, fail at those clubs?
They were the clubs he was at. I mean, you know,
No. That's true. But is the bigger problem United, Sunderland, and Sociedad?
It's his agent. It's David Moyes' agent. Keeps taking him to these terrible places that no one should ever go.
He wasn't suited to Manchester United, I think, at the time, with the approach that he took to that job. It wasn't the right way to do it. Sociedad. I don't know if it was a massive failure there. I'm not sure about that.
It was pretty bad.
Work out, but it didn't go down or anything like that. But Sunderland obviously didn't work out. I think he came into it with he came into it with the wrong attitude, and that given what Allardyce had done before, he didn't do as well as him. But Sunderland at the same time, where are they now? I don't think that's simply down
joint to top of League
David
One.
Moyes. That is a very troubled club. Yeah, so exactly. That's not simply down to David Moyes. I think it's more the case that, yeah, he didn't do well in those jobs. Does that therefore absolutely make him a bad manager? And there were people writing him off based on that. And I always thought, well, if you can get him into a situation where it will be like it was at Everton, which it is now, that he'll be able to do that. And there are many managers who do badly. I mean, Nuno will probably get sacked by Tottenham, but does that mean that he therefore can't manage a club equivalent to Wolves and do a good job there? You know, he had two seventh place finishes with a side that was promoted.
If when David Moyes had been losing game after game with Sunderland and we didn't know what we know now, it would have been absurd to say, oh, he's doing a wonderful job here. This is a tremendous management performance. Hindsight is a wonderful thing.
It is, isn't it? And also, it's a state of where Sunderland are that you interrupted to crow that they're joint top of League One. Let's rattle through the other Premier League games. Leicester 2, Burnley 2. I mean, we don't need to tell everybody that Jamie Vardy is a brilliant natural finisher. He is, and he proved it again twice. Didn't he at the King Power?
Three times, really.
Maxwell.
It was a hat trick, yeah. Isn't it?
It's a very good point. He did do it three times. Maxwell Cornet scored his first goal for Burnley on his first league start. It was a great finish. And it was Burnley's first goal from open play. So it is very disappointing that Burnley didn't go a whole season just scoring from set pieces. That would have given me, I think, more pleasure than anything else this season. And also a bit of a shame that Chris Wood's goal was chalked off late on, because that was very Burn. That was a very League Two goal with the ball just bouncing around. Watford Newcastle, I thought this was a really good game, Barry.
Yeah, last on Match of the Day, which is generally a sign that it's probably not going to be worth watching. I thought it was very entertaining, full-blooded. That was Aussie referee Jared Gillett's first Premier League game, and he was kept busy, got quite a lot of abuse from the Watford crowd for disallowing Josh King's late inverted commas winner. But it was a very entertaining game. Sean Longstaff scored a great goal. It's one of those games where, you know, Newcastle give their fans plenty of reason to be grumpy, but this is one of those games where Newcastle played pretty well, I thought, should have won, and didn't, and that's the only thing their fans can really complain about here. And it's slightly worrying because they've played six games without a win, and the only team of particular note that they've played against so far is Manchester United, so you'd be slightly concerned about where the win is going to come from, apart from their two games against Norwich. But I thought this was a terrific game.
And the last minute was great fun, wasn't it? With the chances at either end, Jacob Murphy going through, and it's doing the rounds. The local BBC commentator John Anderson sort of summarising, just shouting, "Oh, put it in the net, man!" Just really, really loudly, absolutely sort of summing up how every Newcastle fan felt at the end of that game.
When I saw the lineups for this game, I was really worried. Like Matt Ritchie up against Ismaila Sarr, I thought, "Oh, this could be an absolute bloodbath," but he did quite well. And Ritchie is among the more maligned Newcastle players among Newcastle fans. You know, they think he's just not good enough. But him and with the help of Joe Linton, they did okay against Star.
Jacob says, which panellist would have the best chance at catching Steve Bruce and his lightning pace? This is referring to a clip of FIFA where I think Newcastle win a penalty shootout and, you know, now graphics are so good. It wasn't like this in my day, kids. But the players and managers run on, and Steve Bruce is absolutely rapid. And I don't know why it's so funny, but it is absolutely. If they plan to do it, it's absolutely hilarious. And Alan San Maximum tweeted out, didn't he? How come I've only got pace 91 and Steve Bruce has pace 99? It's definitely worth looking out for. That'll do for part two. Part three will start at a resurgent Everton. Part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. St Mary's, Southampton nil, Wolves 1. And you were just saying there in the break, Jacob, the number of teams who haven't won, was it five teams who have yet to win a game? Is that like the sign of the haves and the have-nots in football, or just a quirk of fate? What do you think?
Ooh, that's a good point. I mean, one of those that we obviously already discussed was within, you know, the West Ham part was Leeds, and they maybe had a couple of games that they probably feel that they could have taken something from, and Newcastle were a bit unlucky. Burnley obviously could have had that last minute goal chalked off, but then I suppose you're looking at poor old Norwich with six defeats, no points so far, and you're wondering what the point of them is what the point of Daniel Farker is in the Premier League. I thought you almost wonder if they should just like sack him when they come up and get Big Sam in and see if they can do it. And if they do go down, just bring Farker back or something like that.
He did say, Daniel Farker, I know I'm jumping around between these two games, but Daniel Farker did say, we're only 3 points behind our plan. Seems like quite a relaxed plan, doesn't it? Oh, fair enough. We're not taking this too seriously. A lot of people take football seriously. We're just going to see how it goes. It'll be fine.
I mean, I was there. I remember I was there the game when they went down last time, which was with quite a few games to go, and they lost 4-0 at home to West Ham. And it was just really... And West Ham were in relegation trouble at that time, and it was just really underwhelming. It was down without a fight, and it just feels like that again. But then you're looking as well at other, you know, Palace only have one win, but have been, before tonight, obviously, they've been quite encouraging under Vieira. But then those other five teams, Southampton, Newcastle, Leeds, Burnley, Norwich, is starting to worry.
Not only did Norwich not sack Daniel Farke, I think they gave him a 2 or 3 year contract extension, which presumably means if they do decide to sack him, and they probably won't, it will be quite costly to get rid. But I'm kind of surprised by how meek and passive they are, but I'm not sure why I'm surprised, because they were the exact same last time. If anything, I think they were a little better last time.
Yeah, I remember saying Norwich are the best team to be bottom in the last, was it the season before last? It's like every other year is a Norwich year, right? That's fine. We just, you know, we just include
them. They sort
them.
Of alternate with West Brom, don't they?
Exactly, yeah. When they're both in the division, then we'll panic. We won't know what to do. Yeah, Norwich with no points from six. Only two other teams in Premier League history to lose their first seven. Portsmouth in 09-10 and Palace in 17-18. From an Everton point of view, like Andros Townsend, a brilliant signing. I mean, it is connected to us getting Troy on to talk football, but his son is doing a tremendous job. And, you know, to score, you can't cut inside when you take a penalty. So that was very impressive of Andros to stroke that away without being able to do what he always does. Let's give Raul Jimenez some praise, Jordan. Back on the score sheet, 336 days after his last goal, and the first since obviously that skull fracture in November last year, took the goal brilliantly. And just just really nice to see him playing and scoring.
And also, he's a really handsome man. I never realised before how handsome and good-looking a man he actually is. But a phenomenal goal scorer. Really good to see him back scoring goals. There'll be a psychological lifting off his shoulders of, you know, having got that goal. And you saw in the celebrations how much it meant to him, not only because it ended up, as I suspected, he was hoping to be the winner, but obviously he needed that goal as well. I did have Wolves in my bottom three to go down this season, but if they're gonna do anything to prove me wrong and shut me up, they're gonna need him to get somewhere near back to his best. I'm always a bit uncomfortable with players having those sorts of injuries, and I felt the same with Christian Eriksen and returning to football. Now we're seeing that he's having a healthy recovery and he seems to be okay. But I remember saying at the time, I don't think he should play again. That's just my personal opinion. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a medic. I just think when you have those levels of injuries, I'm just always a little bit uncomfortable about returning. I get that they want to play, they're footballers, it's their job. And if they get a clearance, then fine, whatever. But I had concerns about whether he would return, but I'm a big fan of his. I think he's probably the best striker beyond, I don't know, the top six, traditional top six, and Vardy. I think he's a top striker, and I hope he gets back to his best for sure. And a comment on Southampton and their manager. I can't work out Ralf Hasenhüttl even. I think he's a really good manager, but all the results and evidence suggests that he clearly isn't very, very good. and I can't quite work out. He kind of flits very quickly between being someone that I think should be linked with the Spurs or Arsenal, that level job. But then you look at the table and they're often in the bottom five, bottom three. So I think they could be in trouble this season as well.
Are you saying Ralf Hasenhüttl is demonstrably a bad football manager.
You've done me there, Max.
Anyway, Palace Brighton Monday night. Brighton could go top with a win, which would just be remarkable, wouldn't it? And as with my Spurs hat on, I'm like, Graham Potter would have been better, but there we are. Any other business? Some interesting goals that have been doing the round, or bits of action. Ipswich scored one of those, striker hiding behind the goalkeeper like a little ghost. It was Macaulay Bonn, and he lurked behind the Sheffield Wednesday keeper in the 89th minute. It was Bailey Peacock Farrell, who's holding the ball, waited for him to drop it, stole it, squared it to a couple of other players, and they equalised in the last minute. On Ipswich, Tim says, a couple of years ago, Baz warned Ipswich fans about the perils of sacking Mick McCarthy and got pelters. Now they're sitting proudly in the relegation zone in League One, having spent about $3 million and being most people's favourites to win the league. Does Barry feel a bit silly now they're doing so well? He says.
Yeah, I got an awful lot of abuse for... I had no big problem with Ipswich sacking Mick McCarthy. My problem was with the vitriolic and toxic abuse being rained down on him by assorted Ipswich fans, because Mick McCarthy is demonstrably a very good, decent, kind man, and not a terrible football manager. And he was operating there with one arm tied behind his back.
Lovely moment in the Bristol City Fulham game when Fulham scored. The players jumped into the away end to celebrate with 13-year-old Reece Porter. You might have seen him. He was on TV. I think Tim Ream surprised him. He'd posted footage of him playing football and had got a load of really horrible abuse about it. He has cerebral palsy and epilepsy. Fulham invited him to the training ground, then listed him as a goalkeeper in the first team squad. It was just football being nice. So we should celebrate that. Chris says, maybe some update on the Ronnie Brunswick incident. You'll remember the 60-year-old vice president of Suriname who made his debut in the CONCACAF League for Inter Moengotapoe, I think it is, against Olympia from Honduras. A video afterwards of Ronnie Brunswick giving money to opposition players in the dressing room. CONCACAF have made a statement. They have fully investigated the circumstances surrounding the integrity concerns raised by a video which circulated on social media. Having assessed the actions evidenced in the video and considered written statements provided by both clubs, they've determined serious breaches of integrity rules occurred after the match. As a consequence, Both clubs have been disqualified from the league. Ronnie Brunswick is banned for 3 years from participating in any CONCACAF competitions. He's 61. I mean, come on. He's 64. Well, that's not fair, is it? Let's finish with an email. Now, Barry, would you like a really lovely email from a listener for whom the pod has made a difference, or an email from someone who had a similar incident to you in Munich?
Munich.
Well, ideally, I'd like to hear the second one, just to know I'm not alone, but I feel it would probably be better to go with the first one, because I don't want to be usurped.
Okay, anyway, this is an email. When we did the mailbag pod, we got so much correspondence, and we don't really get a chance to read them all out, and some of them are really lovely. And this one is from Chris. It says, "Dear Max, Barry, and the rest of the Football Weekly team, I was listening to today's questions answered episode. That last email from a listener really made me want to get in touch. I've been through some dark times over the past year in terms of my health, the kind of dark times where it's no exaggeration to say that I'm fortunate to still be here and be able to write this email. I'd harbored negative feelings towards myself for a long time, not feeling good enough for the people I love, not feeling good enough to be in the position I'm in terms of working towards a PhD, not feeling good enough for anyone or anything really. This culminated in a breakdown at the start of this year, a pretty bad one. Luckily, someone was there to save me. The experience gave me a kick up the arse to make some desperately needed changes. Unfortunately, it wasn't the only downturn I took in terms of my health this year. It's not been the best year. Anyway, I've been listening to the pod for a few years. Listening to you guys has been like spending time with friends during the days when I felt I couldn't turn to anyone about how I was feeling, and we weren't able to actually see friends in person. Plus, the episodes in which guests and hosts talked about mental health helped motivate me to make some changes. Since that shitty day in January, I've managed to quit smoking after 12 years of trashing my lungs. Come on, Baz. If I can do it at 27 after that long, then you can too. To keep on with my cycling and push myself to go further, I now grow my own plants, fruit and veg. I've gotten back into reading again. I've been progressing through therapy to help me understand why I have these negative feelings, and now I'm on my way to conquering them. You guys might think that a podcast about football hosted by a few mates that spend the majority of the time joking around isn't exactly akin to therapy. No, it's not quite therapy, but you've helped to keep me and so many others going with jokes, political analysis, and some tender moments at what has been an incredibly hard time in all of our lives. I may have gone through the ringer this year, but listening to you guys has really helped by giving me a bit of normality, giving us a bit of time with some friends, something I and so many have desperately needed. I don't mind if this doesn't get read out on the show. I just wanted to let you guys know how great you've been, even Baz. Keep it up. Thank you so much, Chris." And yeah, for anyone not feeling great at the minute, in the UK, the charity Mind is available on 0300 123 3393, Childline 0800 1111. In the US, Mental Health America is available on 800 273 8255. In Australia, support is available at Beyond Blue 1300 224636, Lifeline on 131114, and Men's Line on 1300 789 978. We don't often read those messages out, but I think it's important to do it sometimes. And we appreciate
you. I'm not sure the even Baz caveat at the end was required there. It was doing really well until that bit.
I think it was said with love. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to email us about anything, by the way, it's footballweekly at theguardian.com. And we've got Champions League this week, so we'll be back on Wednesday and Thursday. But for the time being, Jordan, thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Jacob, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
See you on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.